From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Some Israeli leaders are convinced there's a window of opportunity for preventing Iran from developing a nuclear weapon and that the window is closing. The reasoning here goes that once Iran has the know-how, the raw material, the equipment to make a bomb, it will be too late. Others in the Israeli government say a military attack on Iran will only bring a larger regional war and more threats to Israel's security. The tension makes it difficult to remember that Israel and Iran were once practically allies in the region. They shared common enemies, common threats. Today in the program, we're exploring the relationship between the two countries. The analysts Dalia Dasa-Kay and Ali Reza Nader will join us to explain the history of the relationship, how they got to this point, and how you manage the rivalry without going to war. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the relationship between Israel and Iran. Right now, some Israeli leaders are convinced there's a window of opportunity for preventing Iran from developing a nuclear weapon, and they say that window is closing, so it's crucial to act soon. Others in the Israeli government say a military attack on Iran's nuclear facilities will only bring more threats to Israel's security. With all the tension, it would be easy to forget that the two countries were once practically allies in the region. They had shared threats and enemies. Today in the program, we're exploring, as I said, the relationship between those two countries, how they arrived at the brink of war. We'll have scholars with us to make a case that they're not necessarily destined for conflict. So how did we get here? We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Ali Reza Nader is joining us. He's a senior international policy analyst at the RAND Corporation. It's a nonprofit policy research group, and he's joining us today from a studio at the RAND Corporation in Washington, D.C. Ali Reza Nader, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Dalia Dasa-Kay is with us, a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation and a faculty member at the Pardee RAND Graduate School. She's joining us today from a studio at the RAND Corporation's offices on the other coast in Santa Monica, California. And Dalia Dasa-Kay, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We should say that Kay and Nader co-authored a recent report about the relationship between Israel and Iran for the RAND Corporation. You can find a link to it on our website at kuer.org/Radio West. Well, I wanted to begin with some history because you've both been writing about all of this. And the fact that not so long ago, Israel and Iran were, as I said in the introduction there, if not friendly, they certainly weren't rivals. And in some ways, I suppose, Ali Reza Nader, you could say they were de facto allies in some ways, I guess.
Yes, the Shah, Iran's monarch, never officially recognized Israel, but the two had very close relations. They had a lot of things in common in the Middle East. They were both afraid of Soviet influence in the Middle East and also worried about Arab nationalism under the Egyptian President Nasser. So that I would actually describe them as de facto allies, as strategic allies. There were tensions in the relationship, of course, but the two countries were close under the Shah.
So Dalia Dasa-Kay, how did it work? I mean, there was a kind of, I suppose in some ways you could say they used each other as counterweights against their rivals in the region.
Yes, exactly. I mean, they, as Ali Reza Nader suggested, they had common enemies that bound them together, but they also viewed the relationship as opportunistically. From the Iranian side, it was a way, from their perspective, to get closer to the United States because they had a sense that of maybe a perhaps inflated sense of influence that the Israelis had with the Americans. So the Iranians thought that, you know, relations with the Israelis would help them get closer to the Americans. And from the Israeli side, they also saw opportunities in the relationship. They thought that relations with Iran would be part of what they call their periphery strategy, which is reaching out to their non-Arab neighbors like Iran and Turkey in the 50s and 60s at that time, well into the 70s, in fact. And that would be a way to counter these Arab nationalist forces that both viewed as common threats. So both sides found opportunities in this relationship.
So I guess the question is why then, And we'll talk about this. I mean, this is the essence of what we're going to talk about today. But why? How did they get to this point? I mean, why didn't in those days, which wasn't so long ago, why didn't Iran, for example, view Israel with the same kind of suspicion that it does today, or its neighbors? Was it because they weren't thinking about it in ideological terms? It was more political, the way they conceived of the world in those days, I guess.
That's true. The Shah, like Dalia said, saw Israel as a gateway for influence with the United States. He believed that Israel had a lot of power in Washington, D.C., the same way, actually, that the Islamic Republic feels about Israel today. There is a perception among Iranian leaders today that Israel has a lot of influence in shaping U.S. foreign policy toward Iran and the wider Middle East. And back then, ideology didn't rule as big a role as it does in Iranian foreign policy today. In a lot of ways, the Shah saw Iran as a rising power in the Middle East. And he was willing to work with Israel to basically enhance Iran's power in the region. For example, Israel and Iran both aided Kurdish insurgents against Iraq in the 70s. Whereas today, Iranian leaders, especially since the Islamic Revolution of 1979, view Israel in ideological terms. Mm-hmm. And as our study has shown, over time, ideology has become even more prominent in Iran's foreign policy toward Israel.
Go ahead, Dalia.
Can I just add that, yeah. That very much is true. The one caveat is that the Shah, even during that period when relations were so much closer between the two countries, even in that period, especially after the 1967 war, when the Palestinian issue really rose in terms of its salience in the regional landscape, the Shah was quite sensitive about his image in the broader Arab world. Mm-hmm. And that's why the relationship remained, even though it was extremely close, with intensive, and our report catalogs this, and extensive intelligence and military cooperation. But the Shah was reluctant to overtly recognize Israel and make this relationship more open because of the sensitivities in the broader region of Iran's role. So I think even before the 1979 Islamic Revolution, there were tensions in the relationship. But there's no question that the rising ideology factor that Alireza talked about was a real sticking point in terms of why these two countries eventually emerged as rivals. But even after 1979, you still actually do have some pragmatic cooperation between the Islamic Republic and Israel. Many people forget this, but throughout the 1980s, because of the common enemy of Iraq, both right. Israel and Iran viewed Saddam Hussein's Iraq as one of their most significant, if not the most significant adversary for both, actually led to quiet cooperation between Israel and Iran even after the Islamic Revolution. So these ideological factors are important, but did not always impede cooperation even after the revolution.
So I guess this it's clearly this seems like, I guess, an obvious question, but what was the effect of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003? I mean, on the transformation of all of this, it must have had a pretty profound effect on that strategic relationship.
Yes, basically, once Saddam Hussein was removed as the major threat to Iran and Israel, the two countries began to see each other as bigger geostrategic threats. After the fall of Saddam Hussein, we saw Shia parties take power in Baghdad. And a lot of these parties and their leaders had been exiled in Iran and still maintain very close relations with the Iranian regime. So Iran's power in Iraq and the wider Middle East was really enhanced after 2003. Also, the Taliban were overthrown in 2001, so Iran's eastern enemy was removed as well. And in 2006, Iran's ally in Lebanon, Hezbollah, managed to fight the Israelis and not be defeated. And this was seen by a lot of people in the Middle East as a victory, not just for Hezbollah, but the Islamic Republic as well. So the downfall of Saddam Hussein really intensified the rivalry between the two countries.
I guess if you look at it strategically, setting aside the legitimate human rights concerns, of course, and other problems with the Saddam Hussein regime. I guess you could see it as a kind of strategic blunder to have eliminated the common adversary of Israel and Iran. That was a huge change for the region, obviously. Dalia Dasakay?
Yeah, actually, we at RAND have done some work on, in fact, we have a report called The Iraq Effect for those interested, where we looked at this strategic fallout of the Iraq War and, you know, in fact, found that there were a lot of unintended consequences of the war. And one of the most important, as Ali Reza suggested, was this increased Iranian influence. And if not in reality, at least the perceptions. And we really went through the entire region to look at how Arab and estates, as well as Israel and Turkey, viewed Iran in the aftermath of that war. And that was one of the most difficult outcomes, was this notion that Iran did you know, lose its two main enemies, and that it was perceived as this rising threat, which absolutely intensified the rivalry and the tensions in the region more generally. So we found many other downsides, actually, to the Iraq War in terms of backtracking on reform and so forth. But that strategic balance of power shakeup is one of the most significant and is, in fact, a fallout that we're still living with today. And from the Israeli perspective, this is when you really saw talk of Iranian influence really rise in strategic circles and among the public. Before 2003, you didn't see much public discussion about Iran. It was more limited to strategic circles worrying about its missile and after 2002, 2003, its nuclear developments. But then there was this sense that Iran was on the rise, and that's what elevated concerns about Iran's nuclear program, was this sense that it's not acceptable for Iran to have a nuclear program with this enhanced influence in the region.
So what is the nature of the Iranian influence? I mean, has this been a strategic move on the part of Iran to cultivate and grow its influence? Does that make sense, Ali Reza?
Yeah. After the 2003 invasion, Iran was perceived, especially as the United States faced an insurgency in Iraq, Iran was perceived as the region's ascendant power. Yeah. And I remember commentators, even some analysts, referred to Iran back then as, quote-unquote, the superpower of the Middle East. But I think we were exaggerating Iran's influence and power across the Middle East. I would argue that Iran does have quite a bit of influence in Iraq to this day. Right. And across the Middle East, but Iraq is not an appendage of Iran. It wants to be an independent country. It wants to be a power onto its own, especially in the region. And especially since the uprisings across the Arab world, Iranian power, we argue, has receded, actually. Iran's biggest ally in the region, the Syrian regime, is on the rocks. Bashar al-Assad may fall in the next few weeks or months. We don't know when he's going to leave power, but the situation doesn't really look good for Iran regardless. Hezbollah could be threatened by Syria's downfall. So Iran's influence is actually on the wane. It's not increasing. Given the current nuclear tensions, I think it's important to remember that Iranian power in the region is constrained by a number of factors, and we shouldn't necessarily view the Islamic Republic as an ascendant power in the Middle East.
Is that the Syria dynamic, for example, is that softening the concern of coming from within the Israeli government?
Well, I would say that there's really mixed views. One of the points of our report is to really try to demonstrate how mixed the views are within Israel when it comes to Iran. There are those who do believe that the fall of the Assad regime would be a great boost in terms of Western influence and the decline of Iran, because, as Ali Reza said, Iran would lose its major state ally in the region. And there is this general sense that Iran has lost tremendous influence because of the uprisings, and its repression at home and its support for repression in Syria is out of sync with developments in the region. But from the Israeli perspective, there are many who still worry about Iran trying to capitalize on the turmoil and the unrest collapsed following the uprisings. And a lot of analysts are worried about what will follow the Assad regime. And chaos on their borders is not particularly welcomed either. So while they certainly would welcome the fall of an Assyrian ally, there's a lot of uncertainty of what would be the aftermath of that. So I think there's a lot of mixed views of what the strategic outcome of Syria would be. But there is a sense in Israel that Iran is vulnerable to an extent. But that said, the Israelis still really hold this very firm view that Iran, with a nuclear capability, would be an extreme threat to Israeli security.
I wanted to ask you more about that sort of the rift within the Israeli leadership. Mm-hmm. As you talk about that, it's been said there are some who say that, you know, that really right now Israel is more inclined to act with a military strike right now than they really ever have been. But then, of course, you write about this intense debate going on within leadership in Israel. No consensus, it seems, about the military option. And you say these divisions cut across party lines. We'll talk about sort of the case for and the case against as we go along. But I guess there is any kind of consensus emerging at all, or it seems like this debate is really going on and heating up in some ways, I suppose.
Well, there's absolutely consensus in terms of the threat Israelis believe Iran poses.
Sure.
Despite our strategic analysis, you know, underscoring how vulnerable Iran may be today, that's not necessarily the consensus in Israel. There's some vulnerabilities, but generally the view is that Iran, especially a nuclear-capable Iran, would have increased influence. It would have greater influence over its allies like Hezbollah. It would give these groups cover to be more aggressive against Israel. Israelis were about a potential nuclear arms race in the region, where Iran's neighbors like Saudi Arabia and Egypt and possibly Turkey would follow their path, a nuclear path. So there's general consensus in Israel about what would be the spillover effects of a nuclear Iran, which are generally viewed as quite negative. What there is division on is, one, whether Israelis should view this as an existential threat, so to speak. There's a lot of rhetoric about Iran being an existential threat, but you hear, in fact, just recently the Mossad head, Tamir Pardoh, said, it reported in Israeli papers that, yes, Iran is this major threat, but Israel should not talk about Iran in existential terms because, really, Israel can defend itself. So you have a lot of defense and intelligence analysts who really are worried about overplaying the existential threat rhetoric, which a lot of Israeli politicians will use, because it suggests that Israel is not able to defend itself and will erode Israeli deterrence. So that's one division. And the second is, of course, on this very heated debate about a military option. And here's where you see, as you mentioned, it cuts across party lines. You have Ehud Barak, who came originally from the Labor Party on the left in Israel, really aligned, it seems, with the Likud Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, favoring at some point, it seems, a military option. And then you have former military heads and defense analysts speaking openly now, at least the former officials, about the dangers of a military strike. So there's very different cost-benefit assessments going on about the dangers of striking Iran. And that's the debate you're seeing. And it has become unusually public in Israel over the past year, which is probably a healthy development given how consequential an attack would be. But there is a division, and nobody knows for sure where, you know, which side will gain the upper hand. And so that's where we stand today.
But Barak, Ehud Barak, has been talking about this window of opportunity to act, mm-hmm. whether or not this is the last opportunity to attack. He's been saying that if Israel or the rest of the world waits too long, that he's called it an immunity zone, the point when Iran will have, you know, everything in place, the know-how and the raw material and the equipment, the distribution, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, if he says for Israel to attack, the window is like 9 months. He says if the U.S. were somehow to attack the nuclear facilities in Iran, they would be like 15 months. What do you think about that assessment?
Well, I think, first of all, that underscores some divergence in Israeli and American threat assessments in terms of when they're, you know, which side believes what the timeline would be for Iran to actually weaponize its program, not just have the capabilities to have a program, but actually weaponize it. I think that the zone of immunity term, the window that you're referring to, is a very ambiguous term. And I think there a lot of analysts believe that today there's already many questions about how vulnerable Iranian capabilities are for a military strike to actually definitively stop the program. And that's today, not a window of 9 months or 12 months or so forth. So I think because of concerns about the fact that Iran has developed this program over a number of years, it's an extensive program, they have extensive scientific capabilities, their program is widely dispersed and deeply buried already, I think there's a lot of people who question this terminology of a zone of immunity. And I that is part of the cost-benefit assessment going on about whether a military strike makes sense. Because if you come from the view that a strike is only going to delay the program, but Iran would still be able to reconstitute it, then you may have a very different view about the risks that are worth being taken for such a, you know, such an action, as opposed to if you think you can actually knock out the program. And most Western analysts do not think the program could be definitively removed. Yeah. So I think that's you know, a debate, you know, in Israel, Ehud Barak often frames it this way, but it's often, I would argue, a false choice between this notion that Israel either has to maybe attack Iran or live with a nuclear Iran. There actually is a third alternative, which Israel could attack Iran, and there still may be a nuclear Iran that emerges because the attack may not succeed. And that's something that many of us worry about, are the long-term consequences for Israel and, of course, U.S. interests of a nuclear Iran in a future where it has faced a military attack.
We should also remember that the Iranian government hasn't necessarily made the decision to weaponize the program. We know that it has a robust uranium enrichment capability, but it is assessment of the U.S. intelligence community that Iran's leadership has not decided to weaponize the program. So I think that gives the United States and the international community the opportunity and the space to basically dissuade Iran from weaponizing. However, if there is an Israeli military strike against Iran's facilities, that could actually propel Iran toward making the decision to weaponize the program. And that is also one of the chief drawbacks in an Israeli military attack against Iran.
You know, the question comes up, you hear all the time, does Israel really have the military capacity to do much damage to Iran's nuclear sites, enough to really make a difference? It's a pretty extensive network in Iran, I would imagine, not so concentrated. Dalia Dasakeh, you were talking about that earlier as well. Does Israel even have the capacity to accomplish this if it wanted?
Well, I don't want to get too technical with operational issues, but, you know, from assessments I've seen, certainly they have a capacity to do some significant damage. The issue is whether they could launch a sustained attack that would really be debilitating in terms of Iran's program in being able to reconstitute itself in the future. And most assessments, public assessments that I've seen, suggest that Israel could at best delay the program probably by a couple years, or what a lot of assessments suggest. So I think that is one of the concerns, that that this won't really solve the problem ultimately and will come with many ramifications, some which Alireza Nader just said, which it actually may provide more incentives for Iran to actually move toward weaponizing its program. And of course, there's concerns about the immediate aftermath of what type of retaliation Israel, the U.S., and others would face in the region from such an attack. So I think that, as Alireza Nader said, that, you know, there is still time from the U.S. perspective to at least test diplomacy. I think the dilemma is that from the Israeli perspective, their time frame looks shorter. And so that's the issue that U.S. policymakers are dealing with today, trying to dissuade the Israelis from taking any action preemptively without allowing sanctions and diplomacy to run their course. So that is where we see a bit of friction in the U.S.-Israeli relationship.
Dalia Dasa-Kay is with us, a senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation and a visiting fellow at the Burkle Center at UCLA. Alireza Nader is a senior policy analyst at the RAND Corporation. It's a nonprofit policy think tank. We invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the relationship between Israel and Iran. We have with us Alireza Nader. He's a senior policy analyst at the RAND Corporation, a nonprofit policy think tank. Dalia Dasa-Kay is with us, a senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation, also a visiting fellow at the Burkle Center at UCLA. I mispronounced that earlier. You can join us, 801-585-WEST is the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. I want to ask about the United States and its role in all of this. Does Israel sense that it has support from the U.S., whether it be overt or tacit approval for some kind of military action? I mean, what kind of messages are they getting, sort of through back channels and in a more, I suppose, sort of overt way?
Well, as I was suggesting before we broke, that there is, to the extent that there's friction in the U.S.-Israeli relationship, it is over this issue of the Israelis being concerned that the U.S. Needs to maintain the pressure on Iran. And the U.S. certainly is giving overt and quiet signals as well that they do not think an Israeli military strike would be a good idea at this point in time. So the Joint Chief of Staff head has and others have not been shy about publicly stating they do not think a military attack makes sense at this point in time. The Israelis are really looking for assurances from the United States, and the Obama administration has given them many assurances. So you see a lot of tough talk coming out of the Obama administration in terms of not accepting ultimately a nuclear-armed Iran, that basically this sanctions pressure that the U.S. has orchestrated, which is unprecedented, in fact, is starting to have an effect. You're seeing vulnerabilities within Iran in terms of its effect on the economy and so forth. So the Americans are really giving Israel the message, we know this is a serious threat for you, it's a serious threat for us as well, for the world, but sit tight for a little longer. Let's see if this sanctions regime can have an effect. Let's see if this pressure is going to bring the Iranians to the negotiating table and may be able to solve the problem without the need to resort to military conflict. So I think that's the message the Israelis are getting. And, combined with that, you see enhanced U.S.-Israeli security cooperation, extensive, probably unprecedented, in fact, in terms of defense, intelligence sharing, and so forth, joint military exercises and the like, missile defense cooperation. So at the same time that you have the Americans telling Israelis, be patient, let's let these other avenues take their course, there's also a U.S. attempt to assure the Israelis with bolstered security and defense cooperation that the U.S. will be by their side to defend them if need be.
How are those messages being filtered through the public rhetoric of an election year? What kind of dynamic is that playing in what you're hearing and then in the way people are talking about all of this?
Well, obviously an election year doesn't make that easy. There's, of course, Republican presidential candidates who have vocally stated that they would support a military option. I think that the Obama administration is trying to stay above politics. I think this issue is important and critical and would be, quite dangerous to move into the political realm. So, hopefully that can continue. People can stay level-headed about it and not try to politicize this issue as one party or another is weak on Iran, so to speak. So, obviously it's having some effect. I think there is, from Obama administration officials a sense that they do need to keep up the tough rhetoric on Iran, keep up the pressure, and so forth. But ultimately, I don't think it's going to lead the Obama administration to shy away from possibilities of diplomacy if they present themselves, which they have most recently. It may fail, but I don't think it's going to dissuade them from pursuing those avenues if they're possible.
Ali Reza Nader, let me ask you about what you're seeing from Israel in terms of other efforts to dissuade Iran. I mean, there's political pressure. There are, you know, sanctions. There's covert measures. You're hearing talk about assassinations of Iranian nuclear scientists. What do you make of the efforts that are being done right now? How do you react to the assassinations as a sort of a factor here? And how is that playing into all of this?
One can argue that a lot of the sabotage efforts, for example, the Stuxnet worm that affected the Natanz nuclear facility, and several thousand computers in Iran. The Iranian government just admitted that up to 16,000. Computers across the country were affected by Stuxnet. One could argue that these efforts have slowed down the Iranian nuclear program to some extent. I don't think they're that effective, however, especially the assassination of the nuclear scientists. What that does in Iran, sure, it may make some scientists nervous, but given the extent of Iran's nuclear know-how, infrastructure, and possible involvement of hundreds of scientists, if not more, in the nuclear program, the assassination of a few is just going to make Iran basically more stubborn, less willing to compromise. It has a nationalistic effect in Iran, where segments of the population may sympathize with the Iranian regime even more. We've seen Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei making it basically try to create a sense of martyrdom out of the assassinations. He's visited the families of the assassinated scientists. The Iranian media has done a good job in portraying them as martyrs or victims. So I would argue the assassination of Iranian scientists is counterproductive. I don't think it's necessarily going to slow down the program. Iran still has the universities and the knowledge to churn out these scientists. So if we look for a solution, it has to be ultimately a diplomatic solution if we want Iran to help us achieve a solution on the nuclear program. And then we can discuss whether a diplomatic option is very possible given the state of tensions. I would argue that chances for diplomacy are actually low given the sort of pressure we're placing in Iran. Sure, it feels a lot of pressure right now. The economy has deteriorated. But we have to ask, has the Iranian regime changed its mind on the nuclear program?
I wonder, there's some discussion within Israel that Iran getting a nuclear weapon could be inevitable, but the way forward isn't through the military. It's to change the regime. I wonder, is that viewpoint holding sway at all? And how do you cultivate leaders who are more pragmatic than ideological, people who are wanting to reform? I mean, there is that movement within Iran, is there not?
Sure. First, I don't think the United States can change a regime in Iran. Well, we saw that attempts to change a regime in Iraq have led to strategic blunders, if you will. Today's Iraq is not exactly the ideal country we hope for. It's internally divided. It faces a lot of sectarian tensions and potential conflict. The United States was able to change Iran's government in 1953, and because of U.S. actions in 1953, we see a lot of animosity between the Islamic Republic and the United States. So the United States doesn't necessarily have the authority or really the power to change the regime in Iran. There are, however, groups in Iran, the reformists, the Green Movement, that desire more democratic political system, a more popular political system, and a less authoritarian regime. And what the United States should do is to refrain from policies that hinder the development of democratic norms in Iran. And I think right now that's a tall order because of the nuclear program, the focus, the U.S. and the Israeli focus is to stop the nuclear program. So we've seen sanctions that actually hurt the Iranian population and hurt the reformists and the Green Movement. But our ultimate objective has to be a government in Iran that is more amenable to negotiating with the United States, that's more amenable to opening up Iran's nuclear facilities. I do not think that as long as the Islamic Republic exists, we're going to get rid of all our problems. I think the nuclear program is but one manifestation of our issues with the Islamic Republic. Of course, it's very consequential and dangerous to U.S. interests in the Middle East. But ultimately, we want to see a better regime in Iran. Having said that, it's up to the Iranian people to effect that sort of change within their own country.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's take some phone calls. Samahan is with us in Salt Lake City. Samahan, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure.
You know, I don't think we can talk about this Middle East issue, and particularly the issue, the tensions between Iran and Israel, without talking about the plight of the Palestinians. You know, the Palestinians every day are suffering more and more house demolitions, more and more ethnic cleansing, and more settlements are being built. And currently, I doubt if a two-state solution will work. I think that Israel has completely destroyed that possibility. We're only looking at one possibility or two, an apartheid regime in Israel or a one-state solution. And until those are addressed, there will be no peace in the Middle East, and i.e. between the rest of the world. So that would be my comment, and I would like to hear their opinion.
Dalia Dasake, you want to take that?
Yeah, I think there these issues are linked to an extent, the Palestinian issue and the Iranian issue, but they've been linked differently over time in the Israeli thinking. In the past, when you had leaders like Yitzhak Rabin who were pushing a peace process forward, there was a logic in Israel that making peace with the Palestinians would be critical in order for Israel to turn to its further adversary. So, you know, make peace nearby and Israel would be in a stronger position regionally and internationally to confront growing threats like Iran. Unfortunately, in my view, this logic has been turned on its head recently in Israel, and there are those, particularly more in the Netanyahu camp, who actually argue the opposite logic. And this is, you know, in large part because Iran has become such a prominent threat in Israeli strategic thinking today. It's considered the primary threat in pretty much every issue, including the Palestinian issue, is viewed through the prism of Iran. So you have a strong camp in Israel suggesting that actually, before you can solve the Palestinian issue, you need to deal with these threats like Iran. Because without dealing with Iran, you're not going to deal with all these groups hostile to Israel, like Hamas and Hezbollah and so forth. And so, you know, the path to peace is through Tehran. And that's the logic is probably most prevalent today, for better or worse. And I think that's one of the reasons there's not as much urgency in the Israeli public, also because of the legacy of failed peace talks. There's a siege mentality in Israel at the moment. So there's not a strong domestic push for movement on the Palestinian track. And of course, the dynamics on the Palestinian side are not too ripe for that either. So I think that the combination of those factors of Iran really being viewed as the primary threat has really put the Palestinian issue more on the back burner than it most likely should be. But that's the state of play in Israel today.
Samahan, thanks very much. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Let's go to James, who's been waiting in Midland, Michigan. James, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure.
I have agreed wholeheartedly with the previous caller. And I think that any step to lasting peace in the Middle East has to include holding the reins back on Israel, going through with the settlements and their their aggression against the Palestinians, because everything that's done by Israel is seen as being with the tacit approval of the United States. And the Middle East sees Israel as being our lapdog. And I think that if we're going to see any kind of diplomatic solution, we've got to take the notion of nuclear or military aggression off the table. And so I just think it's high time for the State Department and whomever else to take a harder stand against Israel. And I think that with so many politicians capitulating to the fundamentalist Christians in the United States who think that Israel is God's chosen people, and then to see that in large measure our national media has a very strong influence by Jewish leadership at the top, same with money in the top. Wall Street money at the top is largely influenced by Jewish interest. And so I think that, you know, it's hard to say that without being accused of being anti-Semitic, but it's not the case at all. But for all those factors...
James, I'm going to jump in. Forgive me. I think you've made your point and quite well. Let me get a response. Although, Dalia Dasaki, you referred to it earlier. Ali Reza Nader, do you want to add something to that? It's sort of the similar point as from the caller before.
When you look at the Palestinian issue, the Iranian regime has certainly used that issue to enhance its own influence in the Middle East. Iran is a Persian-majority country. It's non-Arab. It's Shia Muslim. The majority of the Middle East population, the Muslim population, especially in the Arab world, are made up of Sunnis. So Iran has used what it sees as resistance to U.S. and Israeli policy on the Palestinians to basically buttress its own position in the Middle East. It has been, however, challenged on the Palestinian issue, interestingly, by Turkey, Iran, one of Iran's historic competitors. So it's interesting how the Palestinian issue is used by powers in the Middle East for their own national interests.
James, glad you called. Thanks very much. Let's take a break and we'll get some to more of your phone calls. That's Ali Reza Nader. He's a senior policy analyst at the RAND Corporation. It's a non-profit policy think tank, speaking from a studio there. Kind of a loud one. We apologize for the noise. Dalia Dasakay is also with us, a senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation, a visiting fellow with the Burkle Center at UCLA. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation about the relationship between Israel and Iran. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back to the phones. Jim is with us in Washington, D.C. Jim, welcome.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My question has to do with looking down the road a little bit. Suppose Iran develops nuclear capability. Could they actually use a weapon on Israel? Israel is so small geographically that I would think that there would be a likelihood that Palestinians, maybe Jordanians, Lebanese, Syrians could also be affected. And, you know, has anyone really considered that sort of strategic angle? I would think that nuclear weapons for Iran would be almost, they couldn't even consider them for use against an enemy such as Israel.
It's a good one. Dalia Dasakay, respond to that if you would. It must be part of the equation going on in this conversation in Iran.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's certainly part of the conversation in Israel. So, you know, on the one hand, I think the caller is absolutely right that, you know, there are a lot of analysts who question whether Iran would actually use a weaponized capability against Israel because they're not necessarily suicidal. In fact, all of our research has shown Iran is an incredibly rational actor, pragmatic at times, despite its ideological hostility toward Israel, is ultimately, its leadership is ultimately interested in survival. So there's a lot of arguments, and I think many Israeli strategic analysts will be the first to say that their biggest concern isn't that Iran will push the button tomorrow, but that, you know, they're worried about the spillover effects of Iran having a capability which would be dangerous enough. The idea that you wouldn't have a stable Cold War deterrence relationship between Israel and Iran because there would be too much uncertainty, you wouldn't have communication between the two, there'd be pressures to strike first, and so forth. So I think the real concern is the potential for escalation and miscalculation that could lead to nuclear conflict, not in a intentional attempt by the Iranian regime, you know, to destroy Israel. You know, having said all that, I think, and when you're in Israel and you talk to people, while there are many analysts who will make that argument, you also hear a lot of emotional views among Israelis and really much fear about Iran. And while they rationally don't think Iran would actually try to attack them, there is this sense that, you know, no one in the world could understand Israel's perspective like Israelis. You know, Netanyahu often talks about the year is 1938, Iran, and Iran is Germany. So there is this sense of a country coming, you know, out of the Holocaust legacy and so forth, that there's the kind of a psyche in Israel about the need for survival, and that they're always the victim and so forth. So I wouldn't underestimate in Israeli thinking how seriously they take the Iranian threat to actually use a nuclear capability against them in terms on the emotional level. Strategically, though, I think most Israeli analysts do believe that Iran would be restrained in terms of an intentional attack for some of the reasons the caller suggested and others that I mentioned.
Jim, glad you called. Thanks very much. Mark is on the line from Salt Lake City. Mark, did that get at your question as well? I know it was a similar line of questioning.
Yeah, he made a good point, but I would only add that the only people more concerned about about Iran getting the bomb is Kuwait, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq. They despise Iran. If we weren't in the middle of that, they would all be at each other's throats. So if Israel bombed Iran, Saudi Arabia would be overjoyed, ironically.
What do you think? Ali Reza Nader?
Right. A lot of U.S. policy is also shaped by the concerns of our Arab allies, especially in the Persian Gulf. There's a very intense rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran for regional influence, especially in countries like Iraq. The smaller nations of the Persian Gulf, like Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, are also worried about not just the Iranian nuclear program, but what they claim to be Iranian interference in their internal affairs. So it's the situation, the nuclear crisis, is not just about Israel. Lots of other countries in the Middle East, even including Turkey to some extent, are worried about Iran having a nuclear weapons capability.
Mark, thanks very much. Let me ask you, Dalia Desakay, you say that there's no silver bullet solution to all of this, this particular challenge that the United States is going to have to be creative, you know, engagement and containment and deterrence, and you write about a number of policy recommendations. Can you talk about, we don't have a lot of time, but can you talk about a few of the things that you think the United States should be doing to help sort of mediate or be involved in this situation?
Well, I'll let Ali Reza speak to what we can do in terms of the specific nuclear issue but on Iran, but in terms of managing the rivalry between Israel and Iran, yeah. I think that, you know, what current policy is doing in terms of trying to discourage an Israeli attack, really focusing on pressure with diplomacy to see if we can't come to some resolution on this. If that fails, I think, or simultaneously, we really need to start opening up channels of communication between the United States and Iran, and for that matter, and this will be more difficult, obviously, at official levels, but over time between Israelis and Iranians, because we need to be realistic about the future, as an earlier caller talked about the future. You know, actually, polling in Israel shows that despite the alarmism on an Iran non-nuclear weapon, 90% of Israelis believe it is an inevitability that Iran will eventually get a bomb. So I think that there needs to be more thinking about how to develop a deterrence relationship, as difficult as that will be, between Israel and Iran. Certainly, it shouldn't substitute for current efforts to stop weaponization, and again, we're not at that point yet, but we need to start thinking about the future a little bit more and thinking about how to communicate our red lines to Iran, what kind of activity the Iranians would engage in that would provoke an American response. We just don't have a lot of communication right now, and that is really risky in terms of potential for escalation and miscalculation, especially with the heated rhetoric this year in particular.
Ali Reza, go ahead.
In terms of solving the Iranian nuclear issue, there is no silver bullet. The United States at this point has mentioned that all options are on the table, including military strikes. I just co-authored a new study, Rand study on Iran called Coping with a Nuclearizing Iran. Dahlia was also a co-author. And in the study, we recommend actually that the military option be taken off the table. One of the reasons Iran, perhaps the chief reason that Iran is pursuing a nuclear weapons capability, is because of the regime's fears that the United States is out to change the regime, like it did so with Iraq and Afghanistan. And so Iran's nuclear weapons program, its alleged program, is born out of a sense of insecurity, really. So Iran is not just pursuing a nuclear weapons capability to dominate the region. It may be one of its goals to enhance its regional prestige and power, but it wants to protect itself. And so the drumbeat for war against Iran coming from certain elements within the United States and our allies is not necessarily conducive toward our objectives of dissuading Iran to weaponize its program, because it hasn't made the decision to weaponize it. If we fail to dissuade Iran from weaponizing, then we'll have to rely on a strategy of containing a nuclear-armed Iran, deterring the use of nuclear arms by Iran, deterring Iran from being aggressive in the region, reassuring our allies, and hope to see a better regime emerge in Iran in the future.
Ali Reza Nader, senior policy analyst at the Rand Corporation. Dahlia Dasa Kay, senior political scientist with the Rand Corporation. They both joined us today. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.